From NPR, it's Jazz Profiles with Count Basie's World. August 21st, 2004, marks the centennial of the birth of bandleader and pianist Count Basie. From humble beginning at the turn of the century in sleepy Red Bank, New Jersey, William James Basie rose to become an American success story. By the middle of the 20th century, Basie took his place in America's family of jazz royalty. This hour, we explore Count Basie's childhood and his pilgrimage to Harlem, the home of the Stride Piano. His arrival there would eventually catapult him onto the world stage. I'm Nancy Wilson. This hour, it's Count Basie's World on Jazz Profiles.
We're at Cafe Society, but we're jumping at the Woodside.
When trumpeter Harry Sweets Edison came to New York in 1935 as a teenager to seek his fortune as a musician, he met Count Basie, and that was the beginning of a lifetime relationship on and off the bandstand.
Everything was in Harlem. Couldn't go to bed. I lived on 130th and 7th Avenue. Art Tatum was playing on 131st Street. Don Redman was playing across the street at 132nd Street. Billie Holiday was singing at 138th Street at a place called the Yeah Man Club. There was Small's Paradise on 135th Street. You could walk, and I walked so much that I just passed out. I just couldn't miss anything. You could see everybody that you wanted to see in the daytime on 7th Avenue. Louis Armstrong, Ellington, James P. Johnson, Willie the Lion was at the Rhythm Club. It was amazing. I was just in awe. Here I am walking down 7th Avenue. Count Basie introduced me to all these people. He was like a father. When I first joined the band, I was 19, and he just took a liking to me, and he introduced me to Ellington, James P. Johnson, Art Tatum, Louis Armstrong. Oh my goodness, it was just absolutely a thrill.
From his earliest days in Harlem, William Count Basie made friends off the bandstand and garnered attention from his peers when on it. His calling card was his ability to make the foot tap. Pianist Oscar Peterson.
Basie was like a religion. The word on the street was that Basie was the greatest timekeeper in the world. That's all everyone talked about. They said, you know, he just raises his hand and the time is there. Nobody could explain it.
Basie biographer Albert Murray.
Basie's hallmark was simplicity, but it was a simplicity which was a result of a distillation which produced music that was as elegant, subtle, and refined as it was earthy and robust.
Count Basie assembled his first band in the mid-1930s at the Reno Club in Kansas City. From then until his death in New York in 1984 at 79, his approach to his band was steady. Just set the pace and let the band swing. What was the secret of the genius of Count Basie? The answer may have come one night in 1981, as Basie relaxed backstage in Chicago with pianist Dr. Billy Taylor.
All through the years, I've seen you play with Sinatra, I've seen you play on television, at the festivals and in concert halls and in all kinds of situations. And the one thing that always comes through to me is that you enjoy it.
It's nothing, listen. It's happiness for me to listen to the band play. You know, everything's going to have to be in line every night. It's such a wonderful feeling for me being around guys. I mean, that you know that you like it and you can feel something hitting you. That's a good feeling.
From NPR, it's Jazz Profiles with Count Basie's World, our centennial observation of the life and times of William James Basie. This hour, it's the man and his music on Jazz Profiles. Your host is Avery Brooks.
He was born August 21, 1904, into a rapidly changing world. It was a new century, and just a year earlier, Marconi had launched the first transatlantic radio message from Massachusetts to England. Henry Ford had designed the first mass-produced cars, and the Wright brothers had made the first controlled flight in an airplane. In sleepy Red Bank, New Jersey, William James Basie began a life of similar inventiveness and merit. The sound he created, that Basie sound, would, like the Marconi, Ford, and Wright experiments, have a profound effect on 20th century American culture.
That band, I think, stands out as one of the monuments in the history of jazz. That wonderful balance between spontaneity and discipline, togetherness, and working as a unit. It's an incredible organism.
I've said this all my life, 4.5 years, blizzards, rainstorms, getting lost, getting to places that we really didn't want to be, sometimes no food, sometimes no hotel, just a whole bunch of stuff. I never, ever, ever heard the band sound bad. 4.5 years of one-nighters. They always sounded good. Many nights they were great, and some nights they were just unbelievable. And you never could figure that out. A lot of times, you'd have 4 or 5 guys down with the flu, and everybody's tired, and you haven't had a chance to shave and stuff like that. Band would roar. Just incredible.
The sound Count Basie created was distinctive and special, and over most of the 20th century, many of the important musicians, arrangers, and singers from the worlds of jazz and popular music would stop what they were doing to have a chance to be a part of that sound. The Basie sound. What was it that made the Basie sound so special? Basie took the best of the stride piano style he learned in Harlem in the early 1920s and forged that music onto the Kansas City style of blues being played by territory bands in the late 1920s. Thank you. came into his own in Kansas City and developed a unique brand of swinging blues that made you want to dance. Basie's approach worked equally well in the dance hall or the concert hall, and in 1936, America began dancing to Basie's unique brand of blues and swing.
The tap dancers, they would go crazy. Man, taps would be flying off of people's shoes, and they'd be dancing their heels off. When you heard the Basie band, if you couldn't dance, you were dancing that night.
With an accent on swing and the precise execution of time, Basie liberated the blues form, and it was no passing fad. Except for a brief hiatus in the early 50s, Count Basie led his big band without interruption from 1935 until his death in 1984. His band became one of the most important organizations for a jazz musician to be a part of in the 20th century, and Basie took his place in the family of America's jazz royalty. It was a family that included the King, Louis Armstrong, the Duke, Edward Ellington, a First Lady, Ella Fitzgerald, an Earl, Father Hines, and the Count, William Basie. I'm Avery Brooks. Welcome to the Count Basie Centennial Radio Project. This hour, it's Count Basie, the man and his music. As a child in the sleepy town of Red Bank, New Jersey, Basie took his earliest piano lessons from his mother, Lillian. He became bitten by the show business bug when the circus came to town. The young Basie loved it so much that he said he'd do anything to be around the circus. He'd even feed the elephants. While he waited for the circus to come to town, Basie worked on his piano, but he fantasized about other instruments. Historian Dan Morgenstern.
Basie grew up in New Jersey. He's from Red Bank. There was a lot of music going on in those days in that area. As he points out in his autobiography with Albert Murray, he had eyes for show business. Of course, he learned to play the piano, although originally he wanted to be a drummer. But then Sonny Greer, the great Ellington drummer-to-be, who was several years older than Basie, kind of got him out of that because he was so good, you know, that he had second thoughts about it.
School and Basie proved incompatible. There was a war going on in Europe, and Red Bank's Palace Motion Picture Theater provided just the relief that the idle Basie needed. And it wasn't long before Basie discovered how to use his ingenuity to find a place for himself in the theater. After doing cleaning, he found his way into the projection booth, and soon enough, he was at the piano, providing musical interludes during the silent movies. Joe Brown's pool hall was the place for musicians to hang out. When Basie wasn't at the theater, he could be found there. Eventually, the influence of Harlem's rich social and cultural life began to touch Basie. In 1923, the Harlem Renaissance basketball team came to nearby Asbury Park. It was there that a Harlem-based chef, Smitty, heard Basie and encouraged him to come to Harlem to play. ¶¶ For any piano player, Harlem in the 1920s was the place to be. And with an assist from Smitty, bass and cohort Elmer Williams headed for Mecca. Dan Morgenstern.
The thing about Basie is that we find him in the early parts of his career as someone who has not yet really found himself, but who is obviously very personable, very adaptable, and already very focused. When he sees that there's an opportunity to do something, to go on the road with a show, he knows how to get those gigs. And he fell in love with stride piano.
It was here in Harlem that Basie got his first professional break, a chance to tour as a pianist with Katie Crippen and her kiddies, part of a burlesque show called Hippity Hop. It toured the Columbia Wheel, traveling the Columbia Burlesque Theaters in upstate New York and the Midwest. Basie biographer Albert Murray.
Roads are being surfaced and automobiles are being proliferated right after the war. The Tin Lizzies and all those things were out. So these bands were much more mobile. When Basie was traveling with the hip-hop singers, they were traveling by Pullman car. They traveled that way. But as the roads improved, by the time I was in high school, all the college athletic teams were traveling by buses. So the bands were traveling by buses. That's the first time he saw Kansas City with all this whiskey all over the place. That really knocked him out.
Count Basie himself.
I'd had the pleasure of visiting Kansas City, which was in the very, very early days, even before the Blue Devils and Benny Moten's band. We were through there with a burlesque show, which I was traveling with, a show named Hippity Hop.
This would not be Basie's last trip through Kansas City. After one magical night on the town with Elmer Williams on Troost Avenue, he never would be the same. Basie recalls that night.
This was a very strange, wonderful, wonderful city. We turned down this street at 18th and Troost, and just turned that corner, looked like the lights were turned on all over the world, seemed like, and nothing but music. All blues. That's where it hit me.
He was from New Jersey and he was operating out of New York. Kansas City was an open town during this time, which was a time of prohibition in the United States. Most cities were dry and alcoholic beverages were against the law. Kansas City was an open town. In the 1920s and in the 1930s, the musicians played popular music, folk music, and the music which became known as jazz and swing music were mainly employed in dance halls and small clubs. It was mainly dance music. It was geared to what amounted to a ritual of stomping the blues away or swinging the blues away or jumping the blues away. That's why it was called good time music. It not only was a part of the Roaring Twenties, which was a boom time, it was also a part of the Depression era of the 30s, in which people not simply celebrated life, but they also purified the menaces to life in order to celebrate life. That's why it was called good time music. You stomp away the blues and stomp in good times.
That's the Jones Law Blues, performed by Benny Moten's orchestra. By 1925, Basie's first experience on the road was over. There was only one place to go to regroup. So Basie headed back to Harlem and got his first steady gig at Leroy's, a club at 135th Street and Fifth Avenue. It was during this time that Basie fell under the spell of Thomas Fats Waller.
Hi there, fellas. What you say? This is Little Fats Waller, my mother's 285 pounds of jam, jive, and everything. So here it is. Watch out. One of my own compositions. Ain't misbehaving, and I ain't healing.
I'm Avery Brooks. You're listening to Count Basie, The Man and His Music.
Ah, yes, look over here, look over here. No one to talk with all by myself. No one to walk with, but I'm happy on the elevation, on the shelf. Hey, misbehaving. Saving my love for you, and you, especially you, yes. I know for certain the one I love. I'm through with flirting, it's you that I'm thinking of. Hey, misbehaving, saving all my love for you.
Although all the pianists had an impact, Basie was most influenced by the flamboyant and joyful Thomas Fats Waller. Before his untimely death at age 39, he would make a lifetime impression on the young Basie.
The main guy that really influenced me was Thomas Fats Waller. That was the man that I really did idolize. Fats taught me how to play what little bit of organ that I do know. I used to watch him and lay around him long enough to try to style a little piano after him, which was quite difficult. I can't get no further than that with that one. So we'll cool it right there.
At the Lincoln Theater down the block on 135th Street, Thomas Fats Waller played a $10,000 Wurlitzer pipe organ, and Basie, captivated, would sit right behind him in the front row and just watch.
Yeah!
Since opposites attract, it didn't take long for the outgoing Waller to notice the reserved and inquisitive Basie.
Fats sort of taught me, you know. I can remember when Fats was working at the old Lincoln Theater on 135th Street. He was playing organ there. Well, I became very interested in the organ, so I spoke to Fats, and Fats asked me to come around to the theater each afternoon. Well, he started me out sitting down on the floor watching the pedals, and I used to have to play the notes with my hands on the pedals. They're letting me the pedal twist of the organ.
Lawrence Schoenberg is the director of the Jazz Museum of Harlem.
When Basie ran into Fats Waller in Harlem, when he came to Harlem in the early 1920s, he was meeting up with a definitive artist right near the top of an idiom. Basie got an elevator to the top level by getting to hang around with Fats Waller, so he was right in the thick of it.
Dan Morgenstern is the director of the Institute of Jazz Studies at Rutgers University.
They're the same age. We usually think of Fats as somehow being old or being before Basie, but they're the same age. It's just that Fats was very precocious and established himself at an earlier stage.
In addition to Waller, Basie also absorbed the lessons laid down by stride piano heavyweights, Willie the Lion Smith. James P. Johnson. From Leroy's was the precursor to Small's Paradise, named Small's Sugarcane Club. Its pianist, Fats Smitty, influenced Basie with his skills as an accompanist. Basie biographer Albert Murray.
Smitty was known for comping. He was a great comp artist. And Basie liked that because playing behind those guys, he was not trying to solo with them. He had this fantastic comping behind the type of exchanges that they were making. So that was a part of the skill that he developed that got him jobs on these traveling shows, like with Gonzale White. They needed background for the acts that basically could do that.
Gonzale White's band was preparing for a tour of the TOBA theaters, short for the Theater Owners Booking Association.
The TOBA, they touched everywhere. In Atlanta, there was Bailey's 88, Oklahoma City, there was the Aldridge Theater, the Pike Theater in Mobile, the Lyric Theater in New Orleans, there was one in Birmingham.
Eventually, the tour took Basie to Tulsa's Dreamland Theater. It was here in Tulsa where Basie heard a sound one morning that changed his life forever. I'm Avery Brooks. That and much more is just ahead as Count Basie, the man and his music, continues. The Oklahoma City-based territory band, Walter Page and the Blue Devils, were in Tulsa to play a dance. They were outside of Basie's flophouse one morning playing to passers-by to advertise their appearance that evening. Theirs was an irresistible sound that awoke Basie from a deep sleep. He had never heard such a sound in all his life. Historian Dan Morgenstern.
Basie himself, his epiphany, so to speak, there is encountering the Blue Devils out of Oklahoma Territory. The Blue Devils only got to make one record, two sides, poorly recorded, but still gives us a picture of what a great band that was.
The
that's where he first encounters men like Walter Page, who will become so important later on to the development of the Basie Band and the Basie Rhythm Section. That band was steeped in the blues, and I think that's where Basie, so to speak, gets his baptism in the blues.
The kid from Red Bank, Count Basie.
18th Street at that time was blazing. I mean, everything was happening. You could hear the blues from any window or door. And that's the most remarkable thing I ever heard. That's when I first got a good taste of listening to a blues singer. I don't know anyone's name, but I do know they were belting out these blues, and wonderful trumpet players and clarinet players and banjo players. I never seen anything like it.
Basie heard the new music, and he just couldn't believe his ears. Looking back, it took just a few minutes for the blues to change him forever. Just a few months later, Basie was invited to sit in with the Blue Devils by its vocalist, Jimmy Rushing.
That's all right, baby. Baby, that's all right for you.
Playing with the Blue Devils had a strong impact on Basie's thinking about music, and he altered his approach to incorporate the blues. Albert Murray.
That got to him even more deeply than ragtime had gotten to him. It made a big difference in how he thought about music, and he wanted to play that kind of music.
With the breakup of the Gonzale White Organization in Kansas City for good, Basie was stranded and out of luck. But thanks to his ingenuity, he would be reborn, both musically and personally. In his biography, Good Morning Blues, written by Albert Murray, Basie reflected on his decision to call himself the Count. He said that it was during this time that I decided to name myself the Count. I knew about King Oliver, and I also knew that Paul Whiteman was called the King of Jazz. Duke Ellington was also getting to be one of the biggest new names in Harlem and also on records and on the radio. So I decided that I would be one of the biggest new names, and I actually had some little fancy business cards printed up to announce, Count Basie. Beware, the Count is here. By 1929, not much was happening with the Blue Devils in Oklahoma City, so Basie headed back to the bright lights of Kansas City and set his sights on finding himself a place in a band led by pianist Benny Moten. Basie biographer Albert Murray.
When he got with the Blue Devils, he was in the Southwest. He was in the territory, but the master musician of the area was Benny Moten. Walter Page was the master in Oklahoma City, but Oklahoma City wasn't Kansas City. Kansas City was a very powerful city run by the guy that gave Truman his start. It was an entertainment town. Thank you.
Prince of Wales, performed by the Benny Moten Kansas City Orchestra. I'm Avery Brooks. You're listening to Count Basie, The Man and His Music. Basie biographer Albert Murray.
Much has been made of Basie's apprenticeship and journeymanship in Kansas City, but we should not forget that it was really not Kansas City that changed Basie's ambition from being a show band musician to being a jazz band musician. That was done by the Blue Devils that first happened to Basie in Tulsa, Oklahoma. The Blue Devils were from Oklahoma City. It was the old slogan that he kept to the end of his life, once a Blue Devil, always a Blue Devil, which spelled a difference between Basie, the entertainment musician, and Basie, the jazz musician. When Basie came back to Kansas City after working with the Blue Devils, his main ambition was to get with the Benny Moten Band, the most prestigious band in the area.
Stern.
Kansas City in the late 1920s was a musical paradise because, as we know, the city was run by Tom Prendergast, who controlled the Democratic machine, ran the city, and he ran it in a benign way. It was wide open. There was music around the clock. There were no closing hours, especially in the black neighborhoods. Kansas City was pretty well integrated when it came to nightlife, but still, there was everything from breakfast dances to late night jam sessions. There's music around the clock, literally, and good music. Tremendous concentration of great musicians and bands coming through all the time. Not just the local people who were there, but even a band like Benny Moten's band, which is formed and based in Kansas City, is a touring band. They go to Chicago to record. They go as far east as New York. They're all around the mid and southwest. Bands like Fletcher Henderson's come through. White bands come through as well. We know of Jack Teagarden sitting in Kansas City. It's just a musical paradise.
Basie was so determined to get involved with Moten's band that he used all means at his disposal to shoehorn his way in. Albert Murray.
He liked to brag about, you know, I always was a conniver. If I wanted to get into something, you know, I would always find a way to work my way in. And he's not an arrogant guy at all, you know, he's an off-headed, quiet, soft guy. But he's watching.
It's cute. He knows how to get a job in Benny Moten's band. Benny Moten is the leader, and he's a piano player. So what are they going to do with Basie? Basie gets himself a gig there as an arranger. It's not that he's conning Benny Moten, but he's not really. He has ideas for arrangements, but he has to get together with Eddie Durham, who's the trombone player, doubling amplified guitar, not electrically amplified, but with a resonator. He's the pioneer of that and a brilliant arranger. Basie learns from him. They concoct these great things. probably the ultimate of their collaborations is Moton Swing, which ironically gets credited on the record to Benny and Bus Moton, who was his nephew, who played accordion in the band. That's a mistake that was not deliberate, because they had written a piece and recorded a piece called Moton Stomp. I think as far as the record label, Victor, was concerned, they mixed up Moton Stomp and Moton Swing, so Basie and Durham's name never got on the original recording. That became like the anthem. Moton Swing is like the anthem of Kansas City swing. And the transition from 1920s jazz to swing is one where Kansas City is really critical. The first really swinging 4/4 jazz that you hear comes out of the Benny Moton Band at its late brilliant climax. Basie's in the band, Hot Lips Page, Young Ben Webster, Eddie Durham, Eddie Bearfield, Walter Page. Hey, what a band.
Swing by the Benny Moton Band. Despite all the talent in the Moton Band, it was hard for them to make a go of it.
It's problematic in the depth of the Depression. It's quite a miracle that Benny Moton Band gets to make those wonderful records in 1932. The things they had to go through, they played in Philadelphia, then they didn't get paid, and they had to go to Camden to record. They had nothing to eat, and this in the depth of winter. It's damn cold, and they make those terrific records all in a day.
Saxophonist Eddie Bearfield was there.
The whole band stood out in front of the Pearl Theater with our bags and our horns, but no bus. They took the bus. So Benny goes off and he finds a big old bus and took us over to Camden, New Jersey. Took us to a pool hall, and this guy took a tub and took one rabbit and made a big stew. And we got bread, a lot of bread, stood around and sopped up this stew and ate this gravy. I always called it cat stew because I didn't figure out where this guy got this rabbit.
Count Basie's Harlem influence can be heard in the Camden, New Jersey record date in 1932 on this version of Toby by the Benny Moton Band. The Benny Moton Band from 1932. Even though it was filled with genius, the Moton Band was not destined for longevity. Moton trumpeter Ed Lewis.
The band split. The first rehearsal they had after that, I come to rehearsal. Booker Washington met me on the corner before I got to the local. Man, you know what's happening. Benny let us go. So I went storming up to him, asking a whole lot of questions. Benny said, your job is secure. I said, well, what about the other guys? We all come up together. I said, well, if you let the other guys go, I know sooner or later I'm going. So he just well to take my notice, too. So Benny says, no, you don't do that. You know, as long as I ever have a band, you'll always be in it. I told him, well, I didn't want to humble myself. I didn't want him to show me no favors. So I said, accept my 2 weeks' notice, and that was it.
Although his band had broken up, Moten still had visions of grandeur. But for him, this would be the beginning of the end. Biographer Albert Murray.
Benny Moten was one of the top guys with political clout and therefore economic clout. His first love was music, not just political power. And his ambition, of course, was to get into the big league. They didn't ever make it. Other bands did it. Lunsford did it. The Washingtonians had done it. He tried, but he died.
When a botched tonsillectomy ended the life of Benny Moten, Moten's nephew Buss tried to carry on with the band, and the key musicians looked for other opportunities.
They thought they were really on their way. He stayed in Kansas City to have that operation. They had represented themselves well, and they were liked. At the Lafayette, they never touched the Benny Moten band for prestige. But the thing about Benny, with all that prestige, it extended all the way to Denver. That's where the band was when he died, because he was getting ready to go out there and then go back across the country. It was April Fool's Day that he died. I was in Mobile. This is 1935. I was a senior in high school. First thing I heard when I got on the campus was that Benny Moten had died.
With Benny Moten gone, Basie faced his own crossroads, and he couldn't have imagined what would lie ahead for him. Fate would lead him east to New York and the world stage. He would not squander his opportunity there, and against all odds, the kid from Red Bank would achieve fame beyond his wildest fantasies. I'm Avery Brooks. We'll find out more next hour on Count Basie, The Man and His Music.
The Count Basie Centennial Radio Project is produced by the Luce Group in association with WBGO-FM and National Public Radio. Jazz Profiles is a production of NPR. For more information, visit our website at npr.org. That's npr.org. Count Basie, The Man and His Music, was written and produced by Jim Luce. Our technical director is Duke Marcos. Special thanks to the Institute of Jazz Studies at Rutgers University, the Hamilton College Jazz Archives, the Mar Sound Archives at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, the Library of Congress, the Center for Jazz Studies at Columbia University, the American Jazz Museum, the Jazz Museum of Harlem, Tracy Turner Design, and to Cephas Bowles, Dan Morgenstern, Robert O'Mealy, Chase Jackson, Wiley Rollins, Monk Rowe, Brian Belanca, Larry Applebaum, Tad Hershorn, Ben Rowe, Samantha McElhaney, and Toby Byron Multiprizes. Major support for the Count Basie Centennial Radio Project comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the Hovland Company, America made audio for the home, at hovlandcompany.com. Oris Automatic Mechanical Swiss Watches at oris.ch. Small Dog Electronics, iPods and Apple Computers at smalldog.com. And Swiss International Airlines, 70 destinations worldwide at swiss.com. Support also comes from National Public Radio, the New Jersey Council for the Humanities, and the New Jersey Historical Commission. This is NPR, National Public Radio.